Good morning, good morning, good morning. It's 11 minutes past 7 o'clock on a Sunday morning. A windy day, to be sure, outside. It is 11 minutes past 7 o'clock. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Thanks for holding down the fort while I...
Guns blazing right out of the gate.
That's right.
Yes, that's how we do it here.
Flying down the hallway.
Yes.
Listen, it is quite crowded downtown.
A little bit.
A lot of people.
Not used to this many people in t-shirts and shorts in
running.
October this time of year.
But, yeah, kind of.
This is the marathon.
Marathon morning.
Yeah.
Have you ever run a marathon?
No, not yet.
Are you thinking maybe?
It's on my list.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, my son is running today, Ben.
Nice.
Ben Verhassel. And
nice.
My best wishes to him. Mm-hmm. He was a bit under the weather.
Mm.
And so he's been really resting up, really, really, really hoping that he feels a little better. But yeah, it's a big day. I would say it's a commitment to run 26.2 miles.
And if you do well enough, you get to Boston.
Is that right?
That's from people that I know that have run this marathon. If you get, in a certain window, you can qualify for Boston.
Wow.
So
all right.
It is an elite group of people.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of people taking part, thousands, so be careful out there on the roads because a lot of roads are blocked, as you heard in the news, JP talking about all the roads you cannot go down, and it all wraps up at the Minnesota State Capitol, and it is going to be windy and warm, but they're still going to run it, sounds like. So 2 years ago, remember, they didn't run it because it was too humid, I think it was.
Yeah, I mean, we're lucky it's not this time around, too.
So. Yeah, that would disappoint a lot of people.
Yeah.
Well, it is about 13 minutes past the hour. We're going to talk. We're going to take a quick break, but I'll introduce our guest, and then we'll get started after our break. We're going to talk about childhood obesity today. It's really an incredibly important issue, one that needs awareness about the leading chronic health condition affecting children. It's pretty serious stuff. Dr. Aaron Kelly is co-director for the Center of Pediatric Obesity Medicine at the University of Minnesota. And we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk to the doctor about what it is, how many it affects, what's the cause of it, what we can do about it. And as always, we invite your phone calls at 651-461-9226. 651-461-9226. We're back right after this. And we are back right now on WCCO. As we mentioned, we're talking about childhood obesity. It is a serious and complex health crisis involving the physical, emotional, and social consequences, and I'm reading this now, characterized by a body mass index at the 95th percentile or above for a child's age and sex. We're going to talk about the causes and what we can do about it and how it all started. Dr. Aaron Kelly, co-director of the Center for Pediatric Obesity Medicine at the University of Minnesota. Welcome to the show, Dr. Kelly. Thank you for coming on.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, well, it's a busy morning. As we said, a lot of folks are out for the marathon this morning, so we're kind of moving through our morning, but we are paying attention to this topic because it really is a bad situation. Can you kind of talk about how big of a problem it is?
Yeah, I mean, childhood obesity, as you mentioned in the intro here, we define it clinically as a body mass index or BMI at or above the 95th percentile. And where we saw the big change was back in the 1970s. And that was sort of the beginning of this epidemic where we were observing an increase in the prevalence or incidence, so the number of kids that are affected by this. And it's really steadily increased since the 1970s, and we're really at a peak right now. What we saw during the COVID pandemic was that it made things even worse. And so this is a problem that affects about 1 in 5 U.S. children and adolescents, so 6 to 18 years old. So it's something that is really highly prevalent.
And along with that, I wanted to get back to the 1970s number. What was happening then? Do you know, have we researched that to find out sort of what was going on then that turned the corner?
Yeah, people have been working on that for decades to try to understand, like, what was it or what things happened during that period of time that led to this. And, most things that we do in science, we think that there are simple answers. And a lot of times that's just not the case. And that is the case with obesity. We think that there are many, many causes, a lot of reasons why we've seen this increase in prevalence. And so you know, in the 1970s, you know, certainly scientists believe that diet has something to do with this, right? So the way that we eat, especially Americans eat, changed in the 70s and thereafter. And so, you know, a move toward more ultra-processed foods, highly palatable, so foods that taste really good but aren't necessarily nutritionally dense. And so eating habits changed. And then, of course, you know, our lifestyles change as well in terms of how much physical activity or exercise we get. So even over the last, you know, 10, 15 years with the emergence of smartphones, video games, you know, which go back, you know, to the 1970s and 80s, these types of things became much more common. So our eating habits changed, our physical activity and exercise habits changed. And then another key ingredient is stress. And so we know that the body responds certain ways to stress. And one of those ways is to increase body fat stores. And, you know, as we're, you know, time goes on and we're living in a very stressful environment in society, that also contributes as well. And then lastly, but probably most important, is the biological aspect of this. So I think most people greatly underestimate the role of genetics. So what the science tells us is up to 70% of our body weight or body mass index, BMI, is genetically predetermined. You know, that's a pretty high percentage. And so this notion that we have, you know, full control over our body weight really isn't quite true, right? We have some agency over that, but a lot of this is biologically driven.
Can you tell... Can you take a test to find out what your genetic predisposition is to obesity?
Not right now. And the reason why is that there are many, many, many genes that contribute to obesity. So if we think about, you know, the human body, it's only been in recent times, right, that we've had an abundance of food. If you go back in human history, food was difficult to come by and you had to work hard for it. And so our bodies are sort of preconditioned to want to store body fat and store it at high levels for those periods of famine or time periods where there, you know, food would not be as abundant. So our bodies are really fine tuned to that. And there's many like mechanisms, different ways that our body works to store these body fat and keep it on. And so because there are so many genes involved, it's not like we can pinpoint one or two and do a test and identify it.
Wow, that is so interesting, isn't it? Dr. Aaron Kelly is our guest. He's co-director of the Center for Pediatric Obesity at the University of Minnesota, where research is done in this area, obviously, to kind of look at some of the complexities and find a way to address the situation, as it will continue to be a problem in our society. And I think people might be thinking if they're not overweight or their children are not overweight, they shouldn't be concerned. But I imagine there's a cost to society along with this. Would you agree with that and kind of talk about that part of it?
Yeah, there is a big cost. There's a lot of research working on this, especially in this new era of the emergence of obesity medications, to try to understand, you know, what is the cost benefit if we're able to successfully or adequately treat obesity on a population level. But most of the data does tell us that obesity really trickles down to so many other health conditions that are very costly. So we view obesity as kind of ground zero for other chronic diseases. So we know it increases a person's risk of cardiovascular disease, having a heart attack, developing type 2 diabetes, certain types of cancers, musculoskeletal problems, quality of life. And, you know, I could go on and on and on. But it really does lead to a multitude of other health problems that cost money. So what we're thinking, you know, those of us who are working in this area is, man, if we can find ways to successfully and durably treat obesity, it really could have a profound impact on human health long term and save lots and lots of money.
And what is going on at the U around this? Do you have studies underway talking? Do you see different patients that have varying levels of obesity?
Yeah, we are doing a lot of work around this. We have my clinical colleagues run one of the largest pediatric obesity weight management programs in the country that offers a whole palette of treatment options. So, you know, for listeners who, you know, you may have children who you're concerned about, please do consider coming to schedule a visit at our clinical program, where we offer the whole gamut of treatment approaches, trying to understand what are the causes of weight management issues in the kids, and then tailoring treatment. So that can include what we call lifestyle therapy or lifestyle counseling, which is working with our doctors and dietitians to try to make healthier eating choices and be more physically active. We also offer obesity medications, which I'm sure we'll talk about in the in the minutes to come. And then we even have a bariatric surgery program for teens as well, for the more extreme versions of the disease. But we really look at it from a wholesale approach. And then we also have a really robust research portfolio as well.
And that's your area of expertise then?
Yeah, so I'm a researcher, a clinical researcher, and I've done most of my work relates to some of these obesity medications. And so our Center for Pediatric Obesity Medicine really leads the world in helping to develop and evaluate these medications. So think Ozempic, Wegovy, Zepbound, Mounjaro. We've all heard about these new medicines, GLP-1s, people call them. And our center really has led the charge in helping to evaluate the safety and effectiveness of these medications in adolescents. And now we're even starting to study it in younger ages, 6 to 12-year-olds as well.
Is it disheartening to think that our little 6 and 5-year-olds are, I would say, suffering in some ways, because even though they don't probably perceive it as such, it is. You know what I mean? When you're heavy as a child, there are a lot of ramifications with that.
There are a lot of ramifications. We have behavioral psychologists as part of our team, and we do research in this area as well. The psychosocial toll is just it's profound, and it's sad. It's really, you know, children. I would say that obesity is one of the last areas where it shouldn't be, but it's still okay to bully or make fun or tease. And, you know, we don't do this anymore because we know better with other, you know, mental health issues, you know, other stigmatizing conditions. But it still is pervasive where kids get teased and bullied, and it really takes a toll on their psychological health. So we know that obesity, particularly in childhood, is associated with anxiety and depression. And we really don't know. The research is unclear right now about the direction of that. Does the obesity come first and then the mental health problems stem out of that, or is it the other way around? We see examples of both of those, and so we think that they're related, and it varies by individual. But, you know, quality of life is much lower in children and adolescents with obesity, and that is sad. We need to do better, and so that's why we're working on this really, really hard to make sure that we can help get these kids on a healthier track for a long, healthy, happy life.
Is it a prolonged and difficult question to answer as far as a child taking Ozempic or one of the other drugs, as you mentioned?
Yeah, these medications in general have been around for quite some time, a couple of decades. These medications, the GLP-1s, were originally used and still are to treat type 2 diabetes in adults. So it's a medication that has multiple actions that can help with metabolic health, but then it was discovered that it also can act by reducing appetite, enhancing satiety, so feeling fuller faster while eating a meal and feeling fuller longer after eating a meal. And then one of the other things that we've discovered with these medicines is that they also can help manage cravings and food noise. So you probably heard, Susie, this concept of food noise.
I've never heard of that before.
Okay, well, can we talk about it? Let's talk about it. So this is a new area that's been discovered really by people who were taking these medications and saying, hey, for the first time in my life, I'm not preoccupied with food. So food noise, the scientific definition as it's being developed right now, is this concept that it's a preoccupation with food or intrusive thoughts about food, always thinking about what's my next meal? What's it going to be? You know, these types of intrusive thoughts happen to a fair amount of people and can be a real nuisance. And taking these medications for many people can quell that. It basically can reduce or even take away this food noise.
Wow.
So there's a lot of cool ways that these medicines work to help manage weight. And what we've shown in the adolescents is that they're highly effective.
Unbelievable. It's good stuff. Listen, it is about 29 minutes past 7 o'clock on a Sunday morning, on Marathon Sunday morning. I'm Susie Jones, along with Dr. Aaron Kelly, co-director of the Center for Pediatric Obesity Medicine at the University of Minnesota, a researcher doing great work, world-known work. We invite your phone calls now in this next half hour at 651-461-9226. 651-461-9226. We will check the forecast and then come back with more of your comments and questions and more information from the doctor after this. And we're back for the second half of the program today. 651. Josh, I had it.
Close enough.
651-461-9226, our guest this half hour, this whole hour, Dr. Aaron Kelly, co-director of the Center for Pediatric Obesity Medicine at the University of Minnesota, where research is being done to try to help those who are dealing with this chronic condition. 1 in 5 kids in the U.S., a complex chronic disease involving, we learned, genetics, environment, social drivers, and it is clinically defined as a body mass index, or BMI, which is the ratio of weight to height at or above the 95th percentile based on U.S. growth curves. I wanted to ask you, Doctor, before we get to some of the questions, because there are a few of these coming in, the BMI index, like for me as a 62-year-old woman, like I'm considered obese because I'm probably 25 or 30 pounds overweight. I mean, is that number, I don't want to say unrealistic, but a tough one to get at your correct zone?
It's a good question. So the body mass index really doesn't tell us directly about body fat. It's just a ratio of height to weight. And, you know, the studies show, the research shows that it is highly correlated to the amount of body fat that is stored. And really in kids, it works better. It's a better indicator, BMI is, of body fat than in adults. So in kids, we're talking again, you know, 6 to 18-year-olds. We know that the sensitivity and specificity, so getting it right, you know, if you have a high BMI, that actually there are excess body fat stores, the percentage is very high. But it's not perfect. And so that's why in the clinical setting, in addition to heights and weights, the clinical care provider will look at the whole picture, because there are instances, although it's rare, where someone could have a high BMI, and most of that is driven from high levels of muscle and not body fat. So it's not perfect, but it's a pretty good indicator.
651-461-9226. A texter wonders, how does obesity affect bone density?
Ah, great question. Yeah, so when the human body carries extra weight, one of the normal adaptations or thing that the body does to make up for that is it typically increases bone density. So individuals with higher body weights or obesity tend to have higher bone mineral content or bone mineral density. And that's interesting in relation to the interventions that we do, back to these medications too. We're very interested in understanding what are the potential side effects, especially long-term side effects of these medications. And one of the things that makes sense that we're interested in, right, is for a developing child or adolescent, we really need to be aware of what's going on with bone health. And so the early research is showing that as body weights go down with successful obesity treatment, bone mineral density tends to go down, but at a normal rate. Normal because that body, the frame, is being unloaded, and so those bones don't need to be holding up as much weight. But it is an area that we're looking at very intensely to make sure that any interventions we do are not causing any long-term harm to bone health.
Mm. A texter wanted to know about the BMI, and if 70% of our BMI is attributable to genes, and our genes haven't changed since the 70s, how do we explain the incredible rise of obesity across?
That's a great question. Yeah, I'm glad that they asked that. It's a very fair question. So, yeah, the genes probably themselves have obviously not changed over that short a period of time, but there is something called epigenetics. So these are the ways that genes function in relation to an environmental change. And so that's another active area of research, is to understand that perhaps in the last few decades there have been some changes to the epigenetics, the functional actions of our genes as they interrelate with the environment. But probably back to this issue where I was talking about in human history, where our bodies are exquisitely designed to want to store body fat and hang on to those depots of body fat at all costs. Really, our bodies are primed that way. And so when you put that priming into an obesity-promoting environment like we have in the current, you know, day, that's where we think we have the issue. It's this combination of the genetic profile or predisposition and then this trigger of the environment that's come into play. So that's where we get into this complex interaction.
Mm-hmm. And everybody, I think, wants kind of a simple answer. You know what I mean? It's like, if you just dot, dot, dot. A texter writes next, 651-461-9226. Ask the doctor about portion sizes. When did we start to get such huge portions? And we'll start there, and then we'll get into more conversations about, you know, what does a parent do if they have a child that is obese?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, portion sizes definitely fit into this as well. I mentioned earlier about the types of foods that we're eating. They tend to be less healthy than they were decades ago. But also portion sizes have changed, right? And that's, you know, when we think about marketing of foods, and if you go to a restaurant, you know, one of the ways we feel like we get good value is if we get big portion sizes, right? So those have been sort of changed and a little bit out of whack. And so, you know, back to this lifestyle therapy kind of issue, one of the things that is talked about is, you know, what is a healthy portion size and what are different ways that you can eat food to get fuller faster, you know, maybe slowing down so that you give your body, your brain a chance to feel full. But certainly portion size is a big part of this.
Are kids pretty open to this when they come to you guys at the clinic? Are they resistant? Kind of talk about that first interaction with kids when they show up and they're clearly obese and need help.
It's complicated. And, you know, again, we have a clinical and research program. And I can tell you from my clinical colleagues, it depends on the child and the family and the dynamics. And so in our clinical program, that's where a lot of time and care is taken by our healthcare providers to really listen and try to understand, you know, what are the issues, what are the challenges. I mentioned obesity is highly stigmatized, right? If people are made to feel guilty about it, and especially parents. So society is really quick to judge the parents if a child struggles with weight. And back to this issue of it being complicated, it really isn't that simple. And so parents, we all as parents want nothing but the best for our kids, but it can be harrowing for the parent for the first time bringing their child into an obesity program because they feel like they may get blamed. That does not happen in our program, but I'll tell you, it does happen in the real world and other, especially in primary care. We have a lot of education to do of doctors and pediatricians about how to do this. But what we do in our program is try to disarm parents right from the outset so that they're not defensive and say, you know what, first and foremost, this is not your fault. You're a good parent and this is not your fault, and we're here to help. We're here to listen. And I think simple words like that can go a long ways to let those defenses down so that honest conversations can happen and we can actually help these kids and families.
How often are the parents themselves overweight?
Yeah, it's hard to, we don't have a lot of research on that, but anecdotally, I can tell you that it's common, right? Mm-hmm. Back to this genetic piece, right, and shared environments, that it's very common to see obesity cluster in families. And again, it's not as simple as just, you know, the environment that they're living in. A lot of it is genetics.
I wonder as well from you, are there different groups of the population? Are there different ethnic groups? Are women more likely to be obese than men? What do you see? I'm sure you look at that, right? Different racial component of this, the ethnic component of this.
I'm glad you asked that, Susie, because, yeah, it's very much related to what we look at. And, you know, right now, of course, we know what's going on in the federal government is that there's a move to not be looking at this. But we can't turn a blind eye at it because we know the science is very clear that certain segments of population, disadvantaged populations, certain races and ethnicities tend to be much more disproportionately affected by obesity. And we think a lot of that, it's not so much, it's really not about race and ethnicity per se. It's about the conditions that surround that. And so we know people and families that have lower incomes, mm-hmm. have less education, less access to healthy food. Because let's face it, right? Healthy food can be very expensive, right? If you go and buy fresh fruits and vegetables, they're expensive, number one. And number two, they go bad quickly unless you can, you know, really use them. And so all these social drivers of health, that's what we call it, the social drivers of health, really make a big impact. And in fact, that's a big area of research in my center, is understanding, like, when we do these interventions, what's the impact of the social drivers of health? To help, we want to make sure that we get the best interventions to people at the right time. And a lot of that interfaces with social drivers of health.
Right, exactly. They talk about, you know, food deserts, where in certain parts of the community, right. there are no stores that offer good choices for food. 651-461-9226. 651-461-9226. A texter writes, before we take our next break, does a person or a child have to take the weight loss drugs for the rest of their lives once started? Does the weight eventually stabilize, and then can the drug be discontinued?
Right. So this is an active area of study. Most of the data so far from adults and what we know in children and adolescents is that obesity is a chronic disease. So once you have obesity, it's going to be mostly, for most individuals, a lifelong issue that's going to need to be managed. So think of it like mental health, anxiety, depression, blood pressure. You know, we don't use treatments for short periods of time for those other diseases and expect that they just go away and then we can pull the treatments. Really, we think that most individuals will need to be on these medicines for the long term, or whatever treatment you're talking about for the long term. However, I'll say briefly that we are actively researching. Maybe there's a developmental window of opportunity that if, for example, these medications are used for a shorter period of time, maybe they can help reset some of the underlying biology so that individuals may not have to be on the medications forever. Mm. Or maybe they can be even on lower doses.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take our last break, but we have more questions coming in at 651-461-9226. Again, our doctor this week is Dr. Aaron Kelly, co-director of the Center for Pediatric Obesity Medicine at the University of Minnesota. We're back right after this. And we're back with the last segment of the show on childhood obesity. Our guest is Dr. Aaron Kelly, co-director of the Center for Pediatric Obesity Medicine at the University of Minnesota. We continue to get text questions, good ones, from our listeners, 651-461-9226, 651.
Let's say it together now.
Okay.
651. Yes.
461-9226. Okay. Doctor, do you think part of the problem is when advertisers are showing plus-size models and even severely overweight people on commercials, hence making it okay to be healthy, in quotes, or overweight? That's an interesting. But the media is a huge driver of this. I'm convinced of it. And I would say more to the thin side, but go ahead and we can address this.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually think that it's a healthy thing that, you know, especially children and adolescents can see real people, peers. You know, we have to, I think, separate the disease of obesity from body size. And I know that it sounds weird to say that, right? But, you know, body size has a whole different range of factors related to it. When we talk about obesity, we're talking about the underlying biology, the genetics, and how we can treat that. Bodies come in different sizes, and that's okay. We know, though, that when body fat levels get too high, that's where we can have some health consequences, but that's going to vary by individual. So I agree with you, Susie. I think a lot of the pressure comes from especially social media for children and adolescents about the thin ideal, and that's where things can start to get unhealthy because, right, kids will engage in sometimes unhealthy behaviors to try to meet this thin ideal. And so I think that it's probably a good thing that we're seeing different, you know, body size diversity in the media.
All right, here's another one. That's a good one. Are there certain times of the year that our body switches into gear to gain weight? I mean, you get that. But yeah, the idea that we're going into winter and we're like bears and we need to store for hibernation.
Yeah. Well, relevant to kids, one thing that we know from the science is that actually the summertime tends to be, on average, a time where more weight gain is observed.
Really?
And it's a little bit, yeah, isn't that interesting? So it's sort of counterintuitive because, you know, if we dial back, Susie, to when you and I were younger, you know, during summer times, we'd get out of school and we, you know, we didn't have these phones in our hands and
no,
didn't
we
play
didn't.
A lot of video games. We got outside and we did stuff. We were active and whatever. But times are different now. And so when you take kids out of the structured environment of school to sort of the more unsupervised summer times, that's where actually less healthy lifestyle behaviors, we can start to observe that. And so we see more weight gain. Now, again, that varies by individual, but that is a phenomenon that we've observed.
Do fat cells shrink in size?
Oh, these are great questions. great questions. Yes, they do. So the research tells us that fat cells, once they are there, once they exist, they always stay, but they can change size and they can shrink. And so when we engage in successful obesity treatments, usually what we're doing is shrinking the size of those fat cells.
Okay. What about children on ADHD medication that causes them not to have an appetite, and when not taking medication, they overeat?
Right. Yeah, actually, so we actually have a study in our Center for Pediatric Obesity Medicine right now looking at one of those ADHD medications as a treatment for obesity in 6 to 12-year-olds or 8 to 12-year-olds. Mm. We know that these medications, in addition to helping treating some of the symptoms of ADHD, can also reduce appetite. And that can be good or bad, right? I mean, we typically have looked at these ADHD medications as that being a negative side effect, the reduction in appetite. However, there are features of ADHD that can make it more likely for kids to gain weight. So successfully treating ADHD can be helpful, but also, if properly dosed, it can help manage the appetite as well in a good way.
651-461-9226, a texter writes, if a boy has typically always been at the top of the BMI to height ratio, yet gaining a bit more as a 10 and 11-year-old, is this concerning? Could this be the start of puberty soon, and will his growth adjust this? Wondering, and this is more the point, I think, for the parent, do you mention it? Do you ever say to a kid, listen, I'm noticing you're putting on weight. I don't know. I mean, it's such a delicate and careful topic. This person says, I don't want to be the cause of depression and anxiety if I say something.
It's a touchy issue, and parents really do have to be careful. I mean, the research tells us that a lot of the stigmatization can come from families, just the teasing within families, mm-hmm. which can seem harmless, but oftentimes is not. And so this does have to be approached delicately. And I think, you know, this could be a conversation that a parent could have one-on-one with a pediatrician, you know, maybe without the child, to try to look at the growth curves and get the opinion of that doctor about, is this healthy, is it not, or is it just something that we should kind of monitor carefully over time? Because it's going to vary by individual. And but yeah, I think as a general rule, bringing the issue up directly with the child can sometimes go the wrong direction in terms of, you know, the stigmatization.
Yeah, I was horrible at it. My daughter's 30, and I was always concerned and worried about her being a little overweight, and she hated it. I mean, to this day, as a grown woman, she says, ugh. You know, Mom.
It's hard. I mean, you know, we try to be, all of us are trying to be the best parents that we can be. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's a tough situation, but it's a situation where, you know, you want to take time to really think about the approach, right? As the parent, like, yeah. I need to be careful about the words that I use, the tone that I use, and the way I approach it.
Yeah. Hey, now at the center, can someone, and we have about a minute left, can someone call and just get a question answered if they're concerned? Like, how would we send people, where would we send people listening today that they might have further questions?
Yeah, people could call, or you can just Google us, the Center for Pediatric Obesity Medicine at the University of Minnesota. We have a website we have contact information. You can email, but certainly, you know, parents out there, if you have concerns, you want to find out more, reach out to us. We'd be happy to talk with you. Again, we have a clinical program. We have a lot of enrolling research studies. And really, we're blessed to have, you know, one of the best centers in the world right here in our backyard in Minneapolis.
Yeah, that's great. Well, Dr. Kelly, thanks for coming on. We really appreciate your time. It's been very informative, and we'll have you on again sometime.
Thanks, Susie. I enjoyed it.
Me too. Yep. Dr. Aaron Kelly, co-director of the Center for Pediatric Obesity Medicine at the University of Minnesota, back after this.